Hello, and welcome to Barks Remarks, the podcast where we talk about the stories from the legendary Carl Barks, creator of Scrooge McDuck and writer and artist of the greatest Donald and Scrooge comics of all time. Join us as we explore his longer adventure stories in their chronological publishing order. We'll talk about what makes them so enduring, their historical context, and how well they hold up today. So get out your reprint and get ready to enjoy our remarks.
Welcome back to Barks Remarks. I'm Mark Severino, a grown man who loves duck comics, loves to talk about the stories of the great Carl Barks. And let's see, am I concerned with my own status, with my own position in society? I am going to say not really, but you know, I can't lie. Everyone is probably on some level. I definitely think of myself as someone, though, who's not too concerned with keeping up appearances. I'm pondering this, of course, because our story this episode is the Status Seeker, and I'm curious if my returning guest for the episode, who goes by the very high status name nom de internet, Bucket Think Tank. Welcome back, Bucket. Are you a man who's concerned with your status?
In some ways, yes. Some with the YouTube channel, yeah, kind of. But in my day-to-day, not really. But I think, as you pointed out, we're all sort of concerned with, on some level, how we're viewed. At the very least, we want to make sure we're not misrepresented. We want to make sure that we're presenting ourselves in a way we're comfortable with, the image we put out to ourselves. And I think depending on where you are, that image can matter more. Your day-to-day person probably doesn't give that much thought to it. But people who want to go for like a higher status, whether they be celebrities or politicians, their image and how they want to show off does matter.
Yeah, for sure. That's really fair. I think, you know, I'm not really interested in displays of status in the way that we're going to talk about with Scrooge here in this story and the whole Billionaires Club or whatever the name of the club is. But it would be dishonest not to admit that, you know, like you run your own, you've got your YouTube channel where you get to talk about various comic book and nerd interests, a lot of Disney ducks, and I've got my own internet presence. And of course, we're concerned with our appearances and self-promotion for these things, right?
Yeah, it's sort of a fun thing, because one thing people will do is they'll have like a shelf or something with a bunch of fun stuff to sort of lend credence to, you know, that they know what's going on. Like they'll even adorn it with stuff like, you know, various omnibuses and other things, just to sort of point out, hey, I know what I'm talking about to some extent, or at the very least, I know how to spend a bunch of money on things I probably didn't need.
Yes, I say as someone who owns probably 3 or 4 copies in different forms of the story that we're going to be talking about. And, you know, what you're getting at is more about like the fans, you know, credibility, what gives you cred, street cred as a fan, right? But that's definitely its own form of status. So let's see, Bucket, I'm excited to talk about this one. We're into the 60s, right? We're getting into 1962. This is definitely the later part of Barks' career, where most people kind of agree that he's lost a step. That sounds unduly harsh, right? He's slowing down a little bit. There are not as many classic stories. I think this is a nice standout of a story as far as his late career goes. There's a few reasons why it's at least a little bit special. I do like this one a lot from a narrative standpoint. I like that it's kind of a rare example of an adventure story that tackles this idea, you know, of status. And you were mentioning before we started recording a couple of other, there are definitely a few Scrooge stories that are concerned with status. You know, you rattled off Yoicks the Fox and, what else did you mention? You had mentioned Hound of the Whiskervilles, you know, is concerned with the, it kind of has a very similar arc at the very beginning. But this is really the only full-length story that is going to weave a pretty cool adventure out of this idea of kind of social snobbery, right? Social climbing.
Yeah. Yolks the Fox is purely about business. You know, Scrooge has an vested interest in acquiring this agreement, this business deal, and it's through the sort of high society fox hunt that he has to pursue it. Hound of the Whiskervilles is Scrooge wanting to show off a bit of his heritage, sort of show that he sort of has some sort of, what's the word I want to use here? Credibility, I think?
Yeah.
Show off his heritage. Here it is sort of, I think, a very idea of sort of proving that he belongs in high society, which Scrooge almost in some ways does look like a parody of a rich person with the top hat and the spats, but he doesn't really act like one.
Yeah. So let me ask you, do you know the term nouveau riche?
I've heard it. I can probably finagle it in a sentence, but I'm going to go for accuracy here, so I'll leave it to you to define.
Sure. I think, literally in French, it's new rich. And it's the idea that there's like, even among rich people, there's kind of a divide between those who have, quote, old money. I'm sure you've seen this over and over in pop culture, right? The difference between old money and new money. I think this is an interesting thing that we're going to see a bit in this story. Scrooge is a great example of new money, right? He made it himself. He is the originator of the fortune, and a lot of the people that he's going to contrast with in this story are a great example. Not all of them, right? Mr. Pink Picasso is a good is not. I suppose he's kind of his own class, but they are examples of old money. I like what this says about class. Not that I'm necessarily agreeing with any of it. There's not a big message here, but I just kind of like the class exploration that it's going to do. It really fascinates me because class is so extremely interwoven with the idea of wealth, right? Like they go hand in hand. Most people who are rich are considered high class, whether they deserve it or not. Class is of course a weird construct that has a lot of other terrible ideas wrapped up in it. But this is one of the things where like it's so tightly knit. There are two ideas that go together, and Barks almost never really explores class that much in the way that he's going to do it here. So for that reason, this one really does stand out a bit to me.
Yeah, there's a sort of interesting view with that. The sort of, when we think of rich people, we do think of the sort of, you know, caviar, expensive suits, grand limos, and that does sort of go with the idea of the old money, and even more so with status. Like, I've watched Downton Abbey, and there are plenty of things like, hey, this belonged to so-and-so in the family, and this right. is where I attended the house of the Tsar and whatnot. These all things have a certain connotation to them, which speaks of the great family. And you can go with, say, Frasier. In that show, there's the whole idea where if you spend a lot of money, it's somehow good. It's somehow better than if you didn't spend a lot of money. Like, you don't know this guy's credentials, but he's expensive, so he must be really good.
Yeah.
Not necessarily true.
Yeah, there really is a lot of great pop culture that does explore those ideas, that has fun with it. So let's do this. Let's dive in here. A little bit of background before we get into the action of the story itself. The Status Seeker was published in December of 1962. You know, Bucket, I haven't really mentioned this in recent episodes, but we're well into the Kennedy administration at this point. And I don't really see a lot of, I'm always interested in whether you can identify anything about politics of the day, kind of in the background and the subtext of mm-hmm. Barks stories. And you know, Barks himself strikes me as such an Eisenhower man. So that's just something I want to keep in mind in this brief period of the early 60s stories here. But anyway, December of 1962, it came out in Uncle Scrooge number 41. This one has had a wider than usual footprint for its publication. 25 countries overall, 125 publications, 8 times in the United States, which is a little bit above average for stories from this era. I've got to think that some of that is because of the DuckTales episode. You know, we'll talk about that after the story itself. But I will say right here that I think it's got to be one of the strongest DuckTales adaptations. So anyway, this is a good, you know, it's a good adaptation as far as those DuckTales episodes go. It's a relatively long story, clocking at 20 pages, you know, which is long at least for this era. And Bucket, before we jump into the action here, I need to send you a couple of the titles from around the world. You know, I love to pander to the international listeners. So I've given you a little menu here. We've got Swedish, Tagalog, and German. And so Bucket, you know, we've got Tagalog as one of our titles from around the world here. I'm very excited about that because I don't usually see Philippines, you know, printings of these. And I thought it was very appropriate because, like, the Philippines, you know, Ripantero would not be too far away if it were real to the Philippines. So what do you think? What are you feeling?
I think I will take Tagalog.
Awesome.
Because I've never even heard of this before. So let's just dive full in. All right. So it is Basta Sikat, which translates to just famous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not the most exciting title, but again, I did feel like I had to include a Philippines reprint. I guess I'll mention, I'm assuming that it's Tagalog. In Google Translate, it just said Filipino. And I know Tagalog is the national language of the Philippines, but there's also like Cebuano and Ilocano and a few others. So I don't know, maybe it's one of those. But anyway, yeah, Basta Sikat. That's fun. And then I was going to note the Swedish title I really liked. It's Bland de Högsta Hönsen, which is Among the Tallest Hens.
Sounds like a Poirot mystery title.
Yeah, it kind of does. Hold on. I'm going to Google it really quick. Swedish Among the Tallest Hens. Bucket, I'm thinking that that's got to be some kind of like figure of speech, right? For the the highest rank person in
like
Swedish.
Talk and walk.
Yeah. That totally has the the feel for that. I tried to Google to see if it's an idiom in Swedish, but like that's a really hard thing to Google if you're Googling it in English. So anyway, those are our international titles. Let's do this. We're going to dive in and talk about this story. And boy, the Status Seeker is a pretty atypical opener right off the bat, right? Barks is always going to do a good job of signaling Uncle Scrooge for people who might not be familiar with the character when they pick up a comic for the first time, that he's a rich person. And we do get some good signaling, but it has very little to do with his wealth. This is about the other people who are at a big like soiree, a big event in the the grand ballroom of the Sweldorf Brastoria Hotel. This, of course, would be a nice little parody of the Waldorf Astoria, the very hoity hotel. And this is great. This is a really cool subversion here, Bucket, because here we've got the richest duck in the world being treated like an interloper in this hotel, right? These very snobbish people are all looking down on him. One lady says, "My word, the people who try to crash parties, even in this place." And we've got another man who's kind of acting as the he's staving Scrooge off, and he's going to turn out to be our McSwine character. We've got a McSwine here, Bucket. Bucket, is this your first time joining me for a story that had a McSwine?
I believe so. I believe it has been.
Mm-hmm. I think this is, let's see, my third McSwine story so far. One loses count, and they're not always consistent. Oh, it's at least three. We did Milkman Donald, and we did, the Forbidden Valley. At any rate, we're into the 60s. We're going to see a lot of McSwine coming ahead. And he says, I say, old chap, were you invited to this affair? And, you know, we have this really neat exchange where he's trying to shoo Scrooge off, saying this is only for important people. And he goes on to say, you know, the sort of people who own things that give them status. And Scrooge kind of rolls his eyes and says, I don't know about the status, but I own the hotel. And so, you know, he's reluctantly allowed to come in and check out the lights. And Bucket, this first couple of pages, you had mentioned as we started that the bookends of this are probably the most interesting, right? Like, because what we get on the first page is like Scrooge's view of this world that he didn't realize he wasn't familiar with, these status conscious bigwigs who all seem to have some marker of wealth and, more importantly, status. Do you want to tell us about some of the things, the tokens that these people have?
Oh, of course, of course. We see Mrs. Snootity is wearing a new Gior gown, and at yesterday's party she wore a new Gasson. She collects designers like some people collect stamps, of course. There's one gentleman who's bought his seventh Cadillac today.
Oh, you know, it would be a Gadillac, right?
A Gadillac, oh, a Gadillac, of course. My mistake, I'm of a lower class. One lacks status these days without seven Cadillacs. And one lady's wearing the Faith Diamond, all right? And not just any Jemmy Femme tryout jewel. Mm-mm. No one will out-jewel her, you know. And they mentioned that the Faith Diamond is second jewel in status only to the candy-striped ruby. Keep an eye out for that one. And, you know, then, of course, we get to some gentleman here dressed in rags. Totally looks like he came out from the trash cans. And he's here because he owns the pink Picasso.
Picasso, right? He is a fake Picasso, which is a fun little bit.
And the gentleman sold his gold teeth to buy it.
I love that guy, right? That is the key one, right? No one likes... you can see the McSwine character. He audibly sighs as he mentions that guy in rags. That's the key thing. It doesn't even matter that he's not rich. He's gotten in because he's got status. And he's using it as his meal ticket to get invited to these parties and stuff himself on the canapé and fancy sandwiches, which I love. So Bucket, this is delightful, right? Because the signaling here is just wild. It's over the top. The reader is meant to be, I think, thrown a little bit off balance here at the rich Scrooge McDuck kind of being schooled on these things. And then it's very fun to see all these little parodies of these items of wealth and sophistication, right? Gior would be Dior, I think, right? So Gior is Dior. Gasini is a Cassini gown. I will admit I did have to look that one up. It's the only thing I was unsure on. Cadillac is easy. That's a Cadillac. The Faith Diamond. What is that a reference to, Bucket? Do you know?
The Hope Diamond?
Yeah, that's it. The Hope Diamond, hope and faith. And as you say, we get that little mention of the candy striped ruby. And I love the pink Picasso. So, you know, Scrooge leaves that ballroom and you can kind of see his mood lowering and lowering as he's talking to his nephews who happen to be there as well about the fact that he doesn't own a status symbol. We're going to have to ignore, for the purposes to make this story credible, we're going to have to ignore all the spectacular treasures that he does own. You know, I think in the real world, that should certainly give him major status. But I guess the fact is a lot of them are maybe a little too historical or archaeological. So, you know, Donald tells him, hey, just buy the top symbol and get invited to all the parties. And you can, Scrooge himself mentions, yeah, it hurts to be an outsider always. Isn't that fascinating? The richest duck in the world, you know, thinks of himself as an outsider. That is what it means to be nouveau riche in a world like this.
In a lot of ways, he is because he is new money. You know, he's in a lot of ways, he's an immigrant. He's, you know, pulled himself up by his bootstraps to accomplish something phenomenal, but he doesn't have the status. He doesn't have the sort of accoutrements that one would view as a man of high society. He's rich, but he's not high society. And it reminds me a lot of the status-seeking statue of Spendthrift. In that one, where, you know, the Maharaja is able to convince people he is the richest man in the world because he shows his wealth. Scrooge doesn't show his wealth. We've mentioned before, like, Scrooge dresses rather normal, all intents and purposes, like, minus the spats and the top hat. He doesn't really stand out because he doesn't want to. It's not practical to him to do that. It's expensive. That isn't who Scrooge is.
Yeah. Okay, so Scrooge is going to go back into the ballroom. And boy, I didn't mention some of the great comic staging here. We should note that the Faith Diamond is so big that the lady needs a little wheelbarrow to cart it around. And we're about to see some background gag characters that are just wearing increasingly over-the-top amounts of necklaces and jewelry. One woman is basically walking under a literal. She's a moving pile of jewelry. So the McSwine tells Scrooge it's easy to name the top status symbol. The candy-striped ruby, of course. And he says, unfortunately, it's been lost for 50 years. And that's going to trigger something for Scrooge. Or when he mentions that it disappeared during the Bazookistan rebellion, that something clicks, saying he says, hey, I own the candy striped ruby. I got it in a horse trade with Bazookian bandits in 1912. So he is in the game bucket, as he says on the next page. He's rich. I'm a social lion. I'm the top symbolier of the status quo. And he's got a handful of the guests tailing after him, offering to buy it. And he wants to show it off, but as he wades through his bins, his barrels of jewels, it does not show up in all the other common gems, and they walk off in disgust. All right. So as those guys are about to leave, he remembers that he traded the ruby in 1920 to King, quote, what's his name, of the island of, and he starts to find it on a globe, but the nephew, one, some, his grandnephews, you know, cannily tell him not to reveal anything, lest those status seekers behind him streak to the island and buy the ruby themselves. And we're only going to hold on to the McSwine character. So he is, I've been calling him McSwine. I do remember now that he is actually Porkman de Lardo Bucket, but you know, he is a McSwine, right? Like, that's clearly who he is, what he is. So I'll be interchangeable about it, I think, going forward. So we see him with kind of a vicious posture saying, in the cutthroat game of status seeking, there are no rules. We transition. This is kind of a bit of a smash cut. I will admit that it may be a little bit abrupt here, right? Because we're going to transition to him just kind of panicking over how can he get to the island secretly, and the nephews recommend that they make the whole trip underwater in a submarine. We've got a quick reference to some mysterious cargo and some boxes that is clearly going to be revealed later, and Porkman de Lardo is at the same docks now with the ducks, and he's gonna pay a visit. Can you tell us, Bucket, where he pays a visit and for what purpose?
Well, as is customary on the docks, there is a lovely establishment for called Burglars, Thieves, and Pirates Union, local charter number 6.5, if I'm not mistaken. He's looking to hire a crew of pirates for hijacking at sea. And luckily, as it is, the Beagle Boys are here, showing once again that when it comes to crime, they can do it all.
Yeah, it's great. So this is definitely Barks, like, one of his hallmarks, having a union chapter for, you know, the Burglars, Thugs, and Pirates Union. And it's going to be very in keeping with the rest of the story as Mr. DeLardo learns that the Beagle Boys, being the best thugs available, will actually give his job status. It's a little silly. It pulls you a little bit out of the story to have maybe, you know, status is seeping into everything, but that's obviously what he's going for, right?
Yeah. You know, who you choose to employ can say a lot about you, as well as, you know, what you can afford. Like, if you can get the best of the best, it does show that, hey, he's a man of high taste, of good money. Granted, you're hiring people to steal, so I don't think they have like the highest of rates, but you know, I'm not a member of the union, so I wouldn't know.
Right. Hey, so I was just looking it up randomly, and this apparently is the third appearance in the Bark stories, at least, of our McSwine character here called something else, and only his second appearance in one of the adventure stories. In between this and his first in Forbidden Valley, he was in Northeaster on Cape Quack. And it looks like Guido Martino and Luciano Bottaro over in Italy actually used him in between his first and second appearance in, wow, I've got to check this. Oh, it's their big parody of the Iliad, because it's 83 pages. All right. So as you say, you know, this transitional part of the story is... It's not as interesting maybe as the bookends, the beginning and the end. I do like it a lot though, right? Like, this is something that we haven't seen before. The ducks traveling via submarine. I know they do it in like Submarine Santa or whatever that Christmas story ended up being called. But let's see. And we see it in the old Donald Duck story, Terror of the River has a submarine. But, you know, it's a little bit unique. It's one of the unique things about this story. So Scrooge is going to take off. Everyone's watching him from the harbor until they submerge, obviously. And we're basically going to get this middle of the story sequence where Scrooge is trying to evade everyone, except there ends up being a ship that's on the same course as them. It has these kind of like very unique signature, you know, well, they look like antenna, and that's what they are. And we're going to see the ducks kind of continuously, you know, trying to juke them, trying to make sure that they're not following them, grow increasingly more nervous. Scrooge calls the mast. He says that he recognizes the ship later as having a queer mast, like a spider's feeler. During this voyage, we're also going to see the reveal of what's in that box. It is going to be peppermint candy that Scrooge makes the excuse he can use it for trade goods. And the nephews kind of accusingly say, oh, are you planning on paying us our wages in these?
The appearance of the ship does look a bit frightening just because of how it's drawn, especially with the background. When they see it, like there's a ship about 1 mile behind us, you know, on the same course. But nothing much is really done with it because it's not that frightening at the end of the day. It's just a ship that's falling behind. The sort of antennas look a bit intimidating, but overall, not much is here at the same time. Because really the story has begun, but it hasn't really kicked in yet.
Yeah, I agree. This transition can feel a little bit dragged out. They're going to pull in to a port, kind of a natural harbor in a place called Hipso Jiva, and lay low for a while, and they're just waiting basically for the ship to get bored, which it doesn't, you know, it stays there. And the nephews are getting bored themselves, despairing that they can't even swim because of sharks. And one of the nephews, growing tired of eating peppermint candy, tosses some overboard, and the sharks all pursue it, saying, and they say, oh, sharks will eat anything. And so they actually do decide to take some of their pay and trade goods so that they can do a little bit of scuba diving. That's a little weird, right? The sharks going gaga for peppermint candy.
I mean, it is true. Sharks will bite just about anything. That is true.
Yeah.
But they're not really going to fight over a piece of candy dropping into the world. Like, they can't be that hungry. They'd have eaten each other before that happened.
Right.
It's a weird choice. Especially the Sharks don't. The Sharks, I believe, don't play another role in this story, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's true. They're kind of called out a little bit more than you would expect. Maybe they would. Barks has a really signature way of drawing sharks. Have you noticed that? His sharks look more like Barks-like than almost any other animal he draws. I'm thinking of Donald Duck's Worst Nightmare and the Lifeguard Days. You can always tell a Barks shark, I think. And that's my remark. On Barks sharks.
Barks remark on sharks?
Yes, yes. All right. So this is really just meant to carry the story forward because the nephews are going to discover something pretty interesting. What do they find?
They find a fish. While they're looking for various other rare fish, they see a fish that seems to be stuck. And they think it's just a trout, but it's buzzing. Like it's fish don't buzz, not anymore anyway. So it's an electronic gadget. So they go tell Uncle Scrooge. Uncle Scrooge goes down like, huh. Oh, it's a magnetic fish. So they take a shovel and they pull the fish off. Well, the magnetic fish off, and they stick down there. They sort of realize that's how we're being traced.
Yeah, exactly. We've got an electronic tracker. I like this. It seems like a clever clever explanation, very logical. And now they're able to sneak past the island, and we've got kind of the next little peril on the way, which is pretty notable, right? They are going to get snagged basically in a just comically large jellyfish, right? It must be the size of I don't know. I just watched the Super Bowl a few days ago, right? So we're Americans. We think in football fields, bucket. It's just something that everyone knows about Americans. We're not willing to adopt the metric system. So what do you think in terms of football fields?
That's about maybe, I think, a whole football field.
Yeah, at least. It depends on how big the submarine is, because it's got to be like they call it the size of a cornfield. So, that does sound about right. It's bigger. It's larger than any jellyfish on Earth. It's the scientific discovery of the ages. But, that's not what we're here for. It's just a comic book moment of peril. And it delays them, unfortunately, while McSwine, DeLardo is going to get suspicious, and he's going to go figure out that he's been taken, and so they're going to kind of try and follow and figure out where they've been. And the ducks are really stuck in the tentacles of this jellyfish. Eventually, the nephews, they're just going to work with the only tool they have, right? The peppermint, Scrooge's, quote, trade goods. So they send up a box through whatever you call the access point in the submarine, right into whatever the jellyfish uses to consume what he consumes. And just as DeLardo and the Beagle Boys' ship is passing by, the jellyfish erupts from the ocean like a balloon. Barks uses a cute little transliteration of jellyfish noises in the word balloon that he translates to "wee." it's a pretty silly moment. It strikes me as sillier as an adult than it probably did for me as a kid, but on the whole, I rather like it.
We could have made this into a Red Bull commercial today.
Yeah, that's right. Candy striped peppermint gives you wings, clearly. So I'm wondering, Bucket, the biggest jellyfish ever, and boy. So apparently, if you Google this, you get some pretty horrific pictures. The lion's mane jellyfish, Cyanea capillata, is the largest among the jelly species, with the largest known specimen stretching across 120 feet from its top to the bottom of its tentacles. So obviously that's more about the tentacle length, but boy, that is still, that is a lot of jellyfish. So, I guess the oceans weren't quite as overfished in the early 60s. Maybe there's something to it.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff in the ocean we still haven't even found yet. So,
right.
Yeah,
it's the size that matches the megalodon that Donald encountered in that 10-pager where he went down in the bathtub. Skype or whatever that I haven't really covered. So Let's see. So you know, fortunately, this does work. The sub is able to break free, but unfortunately, DeLardo and the Beagle Boys have spotted McDuck without even realizing it. And they see the mystery island is, what's the name, Bucket, of the island they've gone to?
Ripentaro.
So, Bucket, if you remember your DuckTales, the pronunciation of this island is Ripentaro, right? We've got a joke. Picture you're holding a bag of chips and you got a Ripentaro. So I always like that. It's a fun, it's one. Sometimes Barks will do these ethnic sounding nicknames and it's a little bit dodgy, but this one just sounds like, I don't know, that's clever to me.
Yeah.
You know, I like it. It sounds plausible without like sounding, there's nothing objectionable about it. There is something maybe a little bit objectionable about the name of the king of this island. He is King Fulacola. And so, all right. So Bucket, I really like this story. And I actually think on the whole, their depiction of, you know, these people I think are meant to be kind of Fijian, Tahitian, you know, somewhere in the South Pacific, obviously, right? I think on the whole, it's a pretty good representation. It's obviously not like culturally sensitive, but as far as these things go, it's not bad. So the people of Ripentaro are... Interesting. Scrooge tells them that he's here to make a big deal, to quote, talk big deal. He's going to use some kind of pigeon, I guess charitably you would call it a trade language, right? He says that he is here to buy the candy striped ruby. And I like this sequence quite a bit, Bucket, apart from obviously some of these, you know, representation issues. The subversion that Barks does here is that they have a totally different idea of status here on Ripentaro, right? The Scrooge is trying to like offer him things like a gold Cadillac, lots of money, Gior gowns for the queen, a Picasso painting. But what use does he have for, they are junk in Ripentaro and that it is no deal. What do you think about this sequence?
I like it because they don't have any need for stuff that is only going to matter somewhere outside of their home.
Yeah.
Like Donald points out, this is big stuff in Duckburg. Like, why would we ever go to Duckburg? Like, we don't even know where that is half the time.
They already live basically on what we would look at as an island paradise, right?
Also, he's the king. What does he need to show off his status for? They know who he is.
Yeah. Yeah. And then here on the next page, we get the nephews asking in a by the way manner. He says, by the way, king, what is the going status symbol in Ripentaro? And the king is smart. You know, he knows exactly what they mean. He's going to express it in pigeon, but he says, you mean what possession makes one man more envied than another man? I guess that's not even pigeon, right? That's great. This is a great beat, right? A great rhythmic timing. He pats his own belly and says, a big tummy. And I like this a lot, Bucket, right? And if you know anything about the South Pacific, So I want to be careful to not overgeneralize here, right? But my understanding of like the countries of Tonga and Samoa is that in fact, this is true, that the definition of beauty, like a large physique, being fatter, is considered more attractive on these islands. So I went to high school in a school that had, you know, quite a few Samoans. And this is something that I've heard a few times. There's like obesity surveys over the years, and they'll generally find that the South Pacific is the fattest region in the world. So like, you know, Barks did a lot of National Geographic reading background for these. I don't think he's just pulling this out of nowhere. I don't know that we can extend it necessarily to status, but it's not weird that the king, who, you know, has more time for leisure and lounging, would be the most attractive of all, in that he would be able to to eat the highest calorie, you know, foods. So the nephews go on to say, now that's a symbol that makes sense. It's one that really packs some weight. And this is the opportunity for Scrooge to make use of his, quote, trade goods. How does the king feel about this new offer, Bucket?
He loves it. The good old sweet kind that makes fat. It's like, you know what? You've got a deal. You have a deal, good sir. Take the ruby. I don't need this ruby. I have a bunch of smaller, delicious rubies. It's fun. It's sort of weird because this Scrooge acts like he didn't intend to bring the candy to trade. He sort of just now realizes he has trade goods. So what were they for, if not to trade? At least in the context provided here.
Yeah, the trade goods has kind of been his cover story, right? He's kind of revealing now, actually, I did have something else in mind. And he tells them that the reason that he brought it was because he knew that the candy-striped ruby would resemble these peppermints. So he wants to use it as a hiding spot. And here we get something that is pretty rare, actually. We get Barks making a reference to one of his previous stories. The nephew says, you tried the same trick before, and the Beagle Boys solved it, remember? And this would have been a few years ago in the story called All at Sea, when he had to get a batch of gold bullion past the Beagle Boys, and he had it processed to look like kernels of corn, and his trading rats ended up saving him on that one. But yeah, All at Sea, it's just a fleeting reference. It is the same gag. So, you know, this does seem kind of like, I would say the same thing that the nephew said here, right? That didn't really work last time because he had to be saved by kind of an external force. And Scrooge just says, phooey on the Beagle Boys. They're not even on this ocean. But in fact, they're holding a gunboat on him as he speaks. And we've got the Beagle Boys boarding their submarine. And yeah, they suss out immediately. This is where they get to earn their keep. They don't have to be too smart, right, Bucket? Like, it's not the cleverest scheme, I would say. If you get on the submarine and you're looking for something that looks like a candy striped ruby, probably the smartest thing would be to have those as a distraction and hide it somewhere less expected.
Yeah, this isn't rocket science, especially because, as the boys pointed out, the Beagle Boys definitely are going to remember the time you did something similar. And they do. Hey, they even mentioned, hey, remember the time Scrooge almost fooled us by making gold nuggets look like corn? Like, yeah, now he's doing it with ruby that looks like candy. Yep.
Yeah. And Scrooge is going to do his best here. He's going to, you know, act like it's just trade goods. And we get a fun little quip where he says, where McSwine / Delardo says, fine, you've just traded it for this. And he hands him a paper target and takes Scrooge a little while to kind of cotton on that he's holding the target that the Beagle Boys are going to fire their gunboat at. So, you know, it's murder this time. Sometimes the Beagle Boys are you know, kind of harmless, and sometimes they're willing to murder Scrooge. I would say McSwine, in my experience, is always down for a good bit of murder, though. So definitely in keeping with any version of McSwine. This next bit is a little bit silly, I guess. One of the nephews grabs the target, tells Scrooge to jump out of the way, and folds the world's, like, must be a record-setting paper airplane folding, right?
Yeah, this is something out of James Bond. This was clearly in the Junior Woodchuck guidebook, you know, making airplanes at the drop of a hat, or combat paper airplanes.
Yeah, I guess if you got that much adrenaline coursing through you, but he does it, and he zips it right into that beagle's eye, causing him to misfire, and they submerge. Again, I'm guessing that you can't submerge in a submarine quite as quickly. This is like even as quick as the paper airplane was folded. The pirates, Delardo and his beagles, are trying to sink him, so they can't report what he did. But they do at least get away nominally, even if they've got their radio rig shot off, leaving them unable to call for distress. So we've got a fun sequence. I like this next. It's kind of predictable, but I like how this plays out, Bucket. Do you want to tell us here what goes on?
So old DeLardo McSwine is saying that, you know, the ruby is the only piece of this stuff that won't taste like peppermint. So the beagles are when they bite a piece of peppermint, they're like, yeah, okay, it's peppermint, they throw it off. Sadly, or maybe appropriately, the peppermints leave a nice trail for the jellyfish friend we had, and he finding out about following the trail decides like there are more peppermints up here, and he decides to pretty much pull the jaws and just go up there and take the whole ship.
Yeah, the DeLardo and the beagles are definitely going to need a bigger boat. I really like the narrator box that reintroduces the jellyfish. It says, underwater is an old menace who's acquired a taste for peppermint. We even see him kind of talking to himself in his own little jellyfish language. And, you know, they react the way you would expect when a sea monster boards you, with DeLardo saying, good night, we're going to be sunk. And just when I've found the candy striped ruby. And, you know, this gives Scrooge the opportunity to re-enter the story and offer up a trade of information. If they send over the ruby in a can, he will tell them how to buy their way free from that monster of the deep, which of course just consists of feeding the candy to the jellyfish. I like what Scrooge says there at the end of the voyage. Do you mind reading his bit of dialogue?
I shouldn't have told the scoundrel that, but I feel the jellyfish earned it.
Yeah, I love that. That cracks me up. And then the story wraps up here pretty quickly here. As the narrator box says, it's back to Duckburg and the social whirl. Do you want to tell us how it wraps up?
So Scrooge returns to the social whirl of it all, and he's greeted with some pomp and circumstance, but also a certain level of annoyance. I see the McDuck character quite often lately, too often. He's stingy, dowdy, and dreadfully boring, and all he can talk about is money, but he owns the candy stripe ruby, the most fabulous set of symbol in existence, so we have to invite him to all the parties, and I mean all of them.
Yeah, I really like the way that ends. It is these snobs are captive to their own obsequious, you know, worship of status. Scrooge seems to be less popular than the pink Picasso guy even, but they're enthralled to the status of it all. They have their rules and they have to follow them, and it's quite funny. Scrooge, you know, is beaming, just wearing the candy striped ruby. It's interesting that ultimately he really does seem to be concerned with status for the sake of status, right? Well, we'll maybe mention one of the minor differences between this and the DuckTales adaptation in a bit, but I like this a lot. I think Barks doesn't, endings are sometimes the weak spot for him, but I really like how he ended this one. I like that it ends pretty triumphantly for Scrooge, and I like how he got what he wants. And, you know, Barks wasn't even concerned with showing some kind of lesson here, and I kind of like that. What do you think?
I think there's something to be said that the who's expected to learn the lesson is sort of the weird part. Like, Scrooge doesn't really need to learn the lesson. His issue is he doesn't always like to feel like an outsider. And that's understandable. We always don't like to feel like the odd one out. It can be a bit much being an individual. So here he is, the beginning. All these high society people look down on Scrooge, and because he doesn't belong, he's nouveau riche, as the saying goes. And now that he is, he has the status symbol by their own rules. He is now the one who has to be invited everywhere. And as they point out, he only talks about money. Essentially, he only talks about business. Old money doesn't know how to make money.
Right.
So it is sort of an off-putting for them. I think really what's consistent here is the idea of status. And I think that plays off pretty well. In the beginning, we see the ridiculousness of status. We have the people with giant diamonds that are just have to be carried around in wheelbarrows. We see the fact that even hiring criminals can bring with you a certain status. We see King Fulacola and how his people view status as pretty much like, look, can it feed you? No, then what do we need it for? All right. Well-fed people are a great status symbol. And now that Scrooge has a status symbol, it's elevated him to the right place, at least in his mind. And the people who just generally don't seem to like Scrooge now have to deal with him because of their own rules.
Yeah. You know what, Buck? I really liked what you just said there, that well-fed people are the best status symbol, right? There's something, I think, very idealistic. I don't know if you meant it that way, but like the status that King Fula Cola was looking for was something, it wasn't healthful, obviously, it wasn't healthy, but it was something that could feed him, right? And there is something tangible about that, right? Like that it would be nice, I think, if the sort of things that fed people brought more status, not to be all moralistic myself. I, at the ending here, I'm really fascinated by the character art of the rich people, you know, all the signaling that he does. Look at the different eyes of the high society ladies. One of them has that kind of like utterly bored look. One of them has the kind of like squinty, nasty look. One of them has kind of a vacant look. They're all kind of different types of, you know, rich and unpleasant caricatures, I guess. And then the men look all look like some degree of phony or another. It's really interesting that Scrooge is so eager to inculcate himself into this nest of complete phonies and terrible people, right? They're being coded here as just awful. And we end the story with him happy about landing amongst them. I've got to figure that if it continued for another page or two, he'd become completely sick of it and feel out of place. But it is interesting where it leaves off.
It would be a lot like Statue of Spendthrifts, where, you know, after it's all said and done and he's proven his point, he's like, you know what? I'm good here. I'm good. Yeah. I've let you all know what's going on here, how you all really fit in this universe, that you're all right here beneath me. That's it. Now I'll never come back here again.
Yeah, this version of Scrooge is a lot less secure than the kind of early 50s version. And so to transition over to reflection, I really like this story. I do think that it's a bit of a standout as far as some of these, like these early 1960s, these ones that are in the later part of his career. It's certainly not like an all-time classic or anything, but as far as like the crop of stories that surround it, I do think it's a pretty notable one. It's so like we had in this year, we had the Midas Touch, Cave of Alibaba, Unsafe Safe, Spicy Tale. I guess it's in keeping. We had some pretty good ones around this time. So maybe it's not that much of a standout, but it's definitely better than some of what is... some of what is to come. Looking at my schedule, this might be kind of one of the last unbroken chains of at least consistently average for Bark stories. But I like this. I like that it's concerned with status. I like some of the dialogue a lot. The art, there's nothing like spectacular about the art here, but there is some really nice detail in the jellyfish and everything. I do find this one quite enjoyable.
I think to me, sort of the weak part is DeLardo. He becomes an antagonist, but he kind of just doesn't really do anything other than look menacing. The Beagle Boys do a lot of the heavy lifting, both in story and on a sort of bad guy level. Like they're the ones who really come off as a bit more devious here. It almost felt like he wasn't necessary, or at the very least, the Beagle Boys weren't really necessary either, if you think about it.
Yeah, they're kind of just generic henchmen in this, which is a little bit of a shame, right?
Yeah, and I don't even think henchmen were really needed. You could have just had like a generic crew.
It did crack me up, though, that they provided him with status, that hiring thugs got him some status. I thought that was quite fun.
Yeah, they do sort of exist for that particular joke there.
So let's talk before wrapping up even any more. The DuckTales episode, right? I think it's a great standout. I loved DuckTales as a kid, Bucket, right? Like I always loved Barks more. I did start reading the comics slightly before I watched the cartoon, but I loved them both around age 8. And this happened to be one of about 5 episodes that my grandpa recorded for me on an old VHS tape. So, you know, sometimes you get really attached to something because you watch it over and over. It's one of the handful of things you have during your childhood that you can just pop on. I know I'm dating myself by talking about a recordable VHS tape, but you know, the episode is pretty well ingrained in my mind. And I've got to say, as far as the handful of Barks adaptations, you know, you and I got to do an episode that hopefully will get released at some point if I get to doctor the audio or something. But we talked a lot about which of the Barks adaptations were the strongest. And I think there's a good case to be made that the Status Seeker is actually the best that DuckTales ever did adapting a Barks comic. What do you think? Is this a hot take? Am I on track?
I don't think it's that hot a take. I think really what sells it is it's different in enough ways that I think maybe sort of improves on it, because in the episode, there's more the idea that Scrooge does feel like an outsider. Like, it helps that he doesn't act like a conventional rich person at the beginning of that episode. He's playing football with the nephews, and a rich lady says, like, if Scrooge McDuck saw you playing on his property, he would be very upset. He's like, I am Scrooge McDuck. No one believes him. So he's like, I need to sort of, I can't have people not know I'm Scrooge McDuck. That defeats the purpose. So he tries to act like a rich person. He then tries to go for a high value treasure. It's not the candy stripe ruby.
Tell us about what is the treasure? What do they, that is one of the big changes. What's the high status treasure that they're going for?
Not gonna lie, I do not remember the treasure.
Okay.
It was an ugly mask.
It is a hideously ugly mask. And honestly, you might be right. That might be a slight improvement because it's very on message, right? So it is the mask of Cthulhu, which obviously is we get a little Lovecraft reference there. It's a take on Cthulhu. But the funny bit there in the DuckTales episode is that everyone is racing and desperate to get this status symbol that is just objectively absolutely hideous, right? So that's neat. That's very on message for the episode.
And I think it's also helps that Scrooge does sort of learn a lesson over the course of it, because even he points out the mask was ugly, which is why I put it back when I found it. But here he sort of is embarrassed by his friends and family. And at the end, he's like, you know, I don't need these rich people, these snobs. I just need my family. He sort of learns a lesson that I think most people would think Scrooge would have learned here. But in the comic, that lesson isn't necessary. It's all about the absurdity of status and how it's sprinkled throughout the entire story. The episode is really about Scrooge and his journey, which DuckTales sometimes does. Usually adaptations try to give Scrooge a lesson to learn.
But you make a good point in saying that I will concede that the episode of the adaptation of this probably is stronger in terms of the character arc that it gives Scrooge. It is a little bit treacly. It's definitely an awe moment at the end. It's very sentimental, and Barks, you know, doesn't usually like to do that, but it is very solidly paced. On the whole, though, I think that episode is probably like the most faithful adaptation. It pretty much straight up adapts Barks' opener, right? We don't have the McSwine character. We have a different sinister high society guy, but like some of the dialogue is ripped straight from it. He's saying, he talks about the hobo, the poor person, the ragged man, saying, oh, he has the pink Picasso, sold his grandfather's teeth to buy it. You know, which I think is probably also an indirect horseradish story reference. But anyway, there's like background characters that are straight out of the story. So it's neat to see them have done a very faithful Barks adaptation that still obviously substituted a launch pad for Donald and so forth. You know, I like that. I wish they had done a lot more of those. I think the episode was better better for having been a pretty faithful adaptation. I like to see it.
Yeah, it's definitely one I think improves upon the story.
All right, so let's go ahead. We're gonna wrap up by checking in on Index and the community rankings where this story places. This one, so as I mentioned, this one's fairly well regarded by fans. It gets a 7.6 out of 10 rating, which is good for number 181 out of all 43,000 or so Disney comics, and barely sneaks, if you just count the Barks Adventure stories, it is in the top 48th percentile. So slightly better than average, which, you know, is pretty good for a story from 1962, I've got to say. I think it merits that rating at least. This is pretty strong. Not a classic, but like a high point of this era.
There's a cleverness to it that I think does a lot of the heavy lifting. But as I've always said, I think for some people, it's just not the story they look for. A lot of people do like their adventure stories, like, you know, the actual fun treasure adventure or Beagle Boys taking money is always fun. For me, at least, I've always liked that.
You know, it's occurring to me, too. We checked in on the adaptation for DuckTales. I don't want to neglect to mention that this did form a pretty key part of the bones of Don Rosa. Big Scrooge McDuck magnum opus, right? The Life and Times of Scrooge McDuck. This ends up being a very fateful part. Rosa ends up providing his own explanation for why Scrooge traded the ruby, you know, which mm-hmm. ended up being to bind the Bombi the zombie character to the island of Ripantero. So that was kind of interesting.
You would think the king would definitely remember Scrooge for that whole thing.
Yeah.
It's more the reason than the fact that he's who he got the ruby from, but also there's like a zombie on the island just wandering around.
So had you actually read the Rosa follow-up before reading this one?
Yeah, I did. Empire Builder from Calistoga is a big read. There's a lot going on, but it is a beautiful story.
Yeah. Excellent. All right. Well, I'm glad we got to, I think we got to cover pretty much everything we needed to about this story. Bucket, I really appreciate. Oh, you know what? I want to make sure. Do you have a favorite panel that you'd like to call out that we didn't dwell enough on?
I do like Scrooge's little pose at the end, the sort of proud, sticking up his chin, saying it with his full chest, "I have arrived." But I think the real standout moment for me, in addition to Louis making that paper airplane, is just King Fulla Cola showing off the big tummy. It's just...
Oh, yeah.
Also, he has the same sort of proud face that Scrooge does at the end with it. So there's something fun about that as well.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good choice. That's a good pick. For my own part, you know, it really is all about Scrooge's whole walk through the hotel plaza where they're having that club. It's really fun just to gaze at Bark's caricature of all these rich snobs. So that'll be my call out. And with that, let's wrap it up. I will invite people to continue to listen to other episodes of Bark's Remarks. Check out Rosa Remarks, our sister podcast. We've got, let's see, our next episode is going to cover... it's going to cover The Case of the Sticky Money, which is a pretty weak story that is nonetheless a showcase for the Beagle Boys. That's what the Beagle Boys should have been in this episode, in this issue. And then you can follow Bark's Remarks on Facebook and sometimes on Instagram. Let's see, Bucket, you got anything pithy to say about status to close this out?
I recently acquired the Karl Barks, some of the Karl Barks library, The Only Poor Old Man,
Omnibus,
the Don Rose Library Volume 1, The Complete Life and Times of Scrooge McDuck, which, and now I'm going to show off here, which I also have is the individual issues, the Omnibus, both physical and digital.
Nice.
Ha ha, ha ha, high society, my nose is turned up at everyone else.
Yeah, I'll just promise everyone that this podcast will give you status.
It will. Only the elites listen to the Barks Remarks podcast, and the other elites listen to the Rose Remarks. There's no other place to go.
That's right. Other than, say, your YouTube channel, right? Be sure to check out the YouTube channel for Bucket Think Tank, and thank you so much, Bucket, for joining me again.
Always a pleasure to be in high society.